Section 2 of Animal Heroes. The Slum Cat, Life 2. Section 6. Jap Malee was a disreputable little Cockney bantam as ever sold cheap canary birds in a cellar. He was extremely poor, and the negro lived with him because the Henglishman was willing to share a bed and board, and otherwise admit a perfect equality that few Americans conceded. Jap was perfectly honest according to his lights, but he hadn't any lights, and it was well known that his chief revenue was derived from storing and restoring stolen dogs and cats. The half dozen canaries were merely blinds. Yet Jap believed in himself. "Hi, tell you, Sammy, me boy, you'll see me with 'orses of my own yet," he would say, when some trifling success inflated his dirty little chest. He was not without ambition, in a weak, flabby, once-in-a-while way, and he sometimes wished to be known as a fancier. Indeed, he had once gone the wild length of offering a cat for exhibition at the Knickerbocker High Society Cat and Pet Show, with three not over-clear objects. First, to gratify his ambition. Second, to secure the exhibitor's free pass. And third, "Well, you know, as one not to know the valuable cats, you know, when one goes a-cattin'." But this was a society show. The exhibitor had to be introduced, and his miserable alleged half-Persian was scornfully rejected. The lost and found columns of the paper were the only ones of interest to Jap, but he had noticed and saved a clipping about breeding for fur. This was stuck on the wall of his den, and under its influence he set about what seemed a cruel experiment with the slum cat. First, he soaked her dirty fur with stuff to kill the two or three kinds of creepers she wore, and when it had done its work, he washed her thoroughly in soap and warm water, in spite of her teeth, claws, and yowls. Kitty was savagely indignant, but a warm and happy glow spread over her as she dried off in a cage near the stove, and her fur began to fluff out with wonderful softness and whiteness. Jap and his assistant were much pleased with the result, and Kitty ought to have been, but this was preparatory, now for the experiment. "Nothing is so good for growing fur as plenty of oily food and continued exposure to cold weather," said the clipping. Winter was at hand, and Jap Malee put Kitty's cage out in the yard, protected only from the rain and the direct wind, and fed her with all the oil cake and fish heads she could eat. In a week, a change began to show. She was rapidly getting fat and sleek. She had nothing to do but get fat and dress her fur. Her cage was kept clean, and nature responded to the chill weather and the oily food by making Kitty's coat thicker and glossier every day, so that by midwinter she was an unusually beautiful cat in the fullest and finest of fur, with markings that were at least a rarity. Jap was much pleased with the result of the experiment, and as a very little success had a wonderful effect on him, he began to dream of the paths of glory. Why not send the slum cat to the show now coming on? The failure of the year before made him more careful as to details. "'Twon't do, you know, Sammy, to enter her as a tramp cat, you know,' he observed to his help. "'But it can be arranged to suit the Knickerbockers. No things like a good noim, you know. You see, now it ought to be royal something or other. No think goes with the Knickerbockers like royal anything. Now, Royal Dick or Royal Sam, how's that? But hold on, them's Tom names. Why, say, Sammy, what's the noim of that island where ye was born?" "Analostan Island, suh, was my native vicinity, suh." "Oy, say, now that's good, you know. Royal Analostan, by Jove, the onliest pedigreed Royal Analostan in the old show, you know. Ain't that foine?" And they mingled their cackles. "But we'll have to have a pedigree, you know." So a very long, fake pedigree on the recognized lines was prepared. One dark afternoon, Sam, in a borrowed silk hat, delivered the cat and the pedigree at the show door. The darkey did the honors. He had been a Sixth Avenue barber, and he could put on more pomp and lofty hauteur than a 5 minutes than Jap could have displayed in a lifetime, and this, doubtless, was one reason for the respectful reception awarded the Royal Analostan at the cat show. Jap was very proud to be an exhibitor, but he had all a Cockney's reverence for the upper class, and when, on the opening day, he went to the door, he was overpowered to see the array of carriages and silk hats. The gateman looked at him sharply, but passed him on his ticket, doubtless taking him for a stable boy to some exhibitor. The hall had velvet carpets before the long rows of cages. Jap, in his small cunning, was sneaking down the side rows, glancing at the cats of all kinds, noting the blue ribbons and the reds, peering about but not daring to ask for his own exhibit, inly trembling to think what the gorgeous gathering of fashion would say if they discovered the trick he was playing on them. He had passed all around the outer aisles and seen many prize winners, but no sign of Slum Kitty. The inner aisles were more crowded. He picked his way down them, but still no Kitty, and he decided that it was a mistake. The judges had rejected the cat later. Never mind, he had his exhibitor's ticket, and now knew where several valuable Persians and Angoras were to be found. In the middle of the center aisle were the high-class cats. A great throng was there. The passage was roped, and two policemen were in place to keep the crowd moving. Jap wriggled in among them. He was too short to see over. And though the richly gowned folk shrunk from his shabby old clothes, he could not get near. But he gathered from the remarks that the gem of the show was there. "Oh, isn't she a beauty?" said one tall woman.
"What distinction?" was the reply.
"One cannot mistake the air that comes only from ages of the most refined surroundings."
"How I should like to own that superb creature!"
"Such dignity, such repose!"
"She has an authentic pedigree nearly back to the pharaohs, I hear."
And poor, dirty little Jap marveled at his own cheek in sending his slum cat into such company.
"Excuse me, madam."
The director of the show now appeared, edging his way through the crowd.
"The artist of the sporting element is here, under orders to sketch the pearl of the show for immediate use. May I ask you to stand a little aside? That's it. Thank you."
"Oh, Mr. Director, cannot you persuade him to sell that beautiful creature?"
"I don't know," was the reply. "I understand he is a man of ample means and not at all approachable. But I'll try. I'll try, madam."
He was quite unwilling to exhibit his treasure at all, so I understand from his butler. "Here, you, keep out of the way," growled the director as the shabby little man eagerly pushed between the artist and the blue-blooded cat. But the disreputable one wanted to know where valuable cats were to be found. He came near enough to get a glimpse of the cage, and there read a placard which announced that
"the blue ribbon and gold medal of the Knickerbocker High Society Cat and Pet Show" had been awarded to the "thoroughbred, pedigreed, Royal Analostan, imported and exhibited by J. Maley, Esquire, the well-known fancier, not for sale."
Jap caught his breath and stared again. Yes, surely, there, high in a gilded cage, on velvet cushions, with four policemen for guards, her fur bright, black, and pale gray, her bluish eyes slightly closed, was his Slum Kitty, looking the picture of a cat bored to death with a lot of fuss that she likes as little as she understands it. Section 7. Jap Maley lingered around that cage, taking in the remarks for hours, drinking a draught of glory such as he had never known in life before and rarely glimpsed in his dreams. But he saw that it would be wise for him to remain unknown. His butler must do all the business. It was Slum Kitty who made that show a success. Each day her value went up in her owner's eyes. He did not know what prices had been given for cats, and thought that he was touching a record pitch when his butler gave the director authority to sell the Analostan for $100. This is how it came about that the slum cat found herself transferred from the show to a Fifth Avenue mansion. She evinced a most unaccountable wildness at first. Her objection to petting, however, was explained on the ground of her aristocratic dislike of familiarity. Her retreat from the lapdog onto the center of the dinner table was understood to express a deep-rooted though mistaken idea of avoiding a defiling touch.
Her assault on a pet Canary were condoned for the reason that in her native Orient she had been used to despotic example. The patrician way in which she would get the cover off a milk can was especially applauded. Her dislike of silk lined basket and her frequent dashes against the plate glass windows were easily understood. The basket was too plain, and the plate glass was not used in her royal home. Her spotting of the carpet evidenced her Eastern modes of thought. The failure of her several attempts to catch sparrows in the high walled back yard was new proof of the royal impotency of her bringing up, while her frequent wallowings in the garbage can were understood to be the manifestation of a little pardonable high born eccentricity. She was fed and pampered, shown and praised, but she was not happy. Kitty was homesick. She clawed at that blue ribbon round her neck till she got it off. She jumped against the plate glass because that seemed the road to outside. She avoided people and dogs because they had always proved hostile and cruel, and she would sit and gaze on the roofs and the backyards at the other side of the window, wishing she could be among them for a change. But she was strictly watched, never allowed outside, so that all the happy garbage can moments occurred while these receptacles of joy were indoors. One night in March, however, as they were set out a row for the early scavengers, the royal Analostan saw her chance, slipping out of the door, and was lost to view. Of course, there was a grand stir, but Pussy neither knew nor cared anything about that. Her one thought was to go home. It may have been chance that took her back in the direction of Gramercy Grange Hill, but she did arrive there after sundry small adventures. And now what? She was not at home, and she had cut off her living. She was beginning to be hungry, and yet she had a peculiar sense of happiness. She cowered in a front garden for some time. A raw east wind had been rising, and now it came to her with a particularly friendly message. Man would have called it an unpleasant smell of the docks, but to Pussy it was welcome tidings from home. She trotted down the long street due east, threading the rails of front gardens, stopping like a statue for an instant, or crossing the street in search of the darkest side, and came at length to the docks and to the water. But the place was strange. She could go north or south. Something turned her southward, and dodging among docks and dogs, carts and cats, crooked arms of the bay, and straight board fences, she got, in an hour or two, among familiar scenes and smells. And before the sun came up, she had crawled back, weary and footsore, through the same old hole, in the same old fence, and over a wall to her junkyard back of the bird cellar. Yes, back into the very cracker box where she was born. Oh, if the Fifth Avenue family could only have seen her in her native Orient! After a long rest, she came quietly down from the cracker box toward the steps leading to the cellar, engaged in her old-time pursuit of seeking for eatables. The door opened, and there stood the Negro. He shouted to the birdman inside, "Say, boss, come here! Here there ain't that royal Analostan and come back!" Jap came in time to see the cat jumping the wall. They called loudly and in the most seductive, wheedling tones, "Pussy, pussy, pussy, poor pussy! Come, pussy!" But Pussy was not prepossessed in their favor, and disappeared to forage in her old-time haunts. The royal Analostan had been a windfall for Jap, had been the means of adding many comforts to the cellar and several prisoners to the cages. It was now of the utmost importance to recapture Her Majesty. Stale meat, offal, and other infallible lures were put out till Pussy, urged by the reestablished hunger pinch, crept up to a large fish head in a box trap. The Negro, in watching, pulled the string that dropped the lid, and a minute later the Analostan was once more among the prisoners in the cellar. Meanwhile, Jap had been watching the lost and found column. There it was, $25 reward, etc. That night, Mr. Maley's butler called at the Fifth Avenue mansion with the missing cat. "Mr. Maley's compliments, sir. De Royal Analostan had recurred in her recent proprietor's vicinity and residence, sir. Mr. Maley had pleasure in recuperating the Royal Analostan, sir." Of course, Mr. Maley could not be rewarded, but the butler was open to any offer, and plainly showed that he expected the promised reward and something more. Kitty was guarded very carefully after that. But so far from being disgusted with the old life of starving and glad of her ease, she became wilder and more dissatisfied. Section 8. The spring was doing its New York best. The dirty little English sparrows were tumbling over each other in their gutter brawls. Cats yowled all night in the areas, and the Fifth Avenue family were thinking of their country residence. They packed up, closed house, and moved off to their summer home, some 50 miles away, and Pussy, in a basket, went with them. Just what she needed, a change of air and scene to wean her away from her former owners and make her happy. The basket was lifted into a rumble shaker. New sounds and passing smells were entered and left, and in the turn the course was made. Then a roaring of many feet, more swinging of the basket, a short pause, another change of direction, then some clicks, some bangs, a long, shrill whistle, and doorbells of a very big front door. A rumbling, a whizzing, an unpleasant smell, a hideous smell, a growing, horrible, hateful, choking smell, a deadly, gripping, poisonous stench with roaring that drowned poor Kitty's yowls, and just as it neared the point where endurance ceased, there was relief. She heard clicks and clacks, there was light, there was air. Then a man's voice called, "All out for 125th Street!" Though, of course, to Kitty it was a mere human bellow. The roaring almost ceased, did cease. Later the rackety bang was renewed with plenty of sounds and shakes, though not the poisonous gas. A long, hollow, booming roar was a pleasant dock smell was quickly passed, and then there was a succession of jolts, roars, jars, stops, clicks, clacks, smells, jumps, shakes, more smells, more shakes, big shakes, little shakes, gases, smoke, screeches, doorbells, tremblings, roars, thunders, and some new smells, raps, taps, heavings, rumblings, and more smells, but all without any of the feel that the direction is changed. When at last it stopped, the sun came twinkling through the basket lid. The royal cat was lifted into a rumble shaker of the old familiar style, and, swerving aside from their past course, very soon the noise of its wheels were gritting and rattlings. A new and horrible sound was added, the barking of dogs, big and little and dreadfully close. The basket was lifted, and Slum Kitty had reached her country home. Everyone was officiously kind. They wanted to please the royal cat, but somehow none of them did, except possibly the big fat cook that Kitty discovered on wandering into the kitchen. This unctuous person smelt more like a slum than anything she had met for months, and the royal Analostan was proportionately attracted. The cook, when she learned that fears were entertained about the cat staying, said, "Sure, she'd tend to that. Once a cat licks her first, sure, she's at home." So she deftly caught the unapproachable royalty in her apron and committed the horrible sacrilege of greasing the soles of her feet with pot grease. Of course, Kitty resented it. She resented everything in that place. But on being set down, she began to dress her paws and found evident satisfaction in that grease. She licked all 4 feet for an hour, and the cook triumphantly announced that now, sure, she'd be apt to stay. And stay she did. But she showed a most surprising and disgusting preference for the kitchen, the cook, and the garbage pail. The family, though distressed by these distinguished peculiarities, were glad to see the royal Analostan more contented and approachable. They gave her more liberty after a week or two. They guarded her from every menace. The dogs were taught to respect her. No man or boy about the place would have dreamed of throwing a stone at the famous pedigreed cat. She had all the food she wanted, but still she was not happy. She was hankering for many things, she scarcely knew what. She had everything. Yes, but she wanted something else. Plenty to eat and drink. Yes, but milk does not taste the same when you can go and drink all you want from a saucer. It has to be stolen out of a tin pail when you are belly-pinched with hunger and thirst, or it does not have that tang. It isn't milk." Yes, there was a junk yard back of the house, and beside it and around it too, a big one. But it was everywhere poisoned and polluted with roses. The very horses and dogs had the wrong smell. The whole country round was a repellent desert of lifeless, disgusting gardens and hay fields, without a single tenement or smokestack in sight. How she did hate it all! There was only one sweet-smelling shrub in the whole horrible place, and that was in a neglected corner. She did enjoy nipping that and rolling in the leaves. It was a bright spot in the grounds, but the only one, for she had not found a rotten fish head nor seen a genuine garbage can since she came, and altogether it was the most unlovely, unattractive, unsmellable spot she had ever known. She would surely have gone that first night had she had the liberty. The liberty was weeks in coming, and meanwhile her affinity with the cook had developed as a bond to keep her. But one day, after a summer of discontent, a succession of things happened to stir anew the slum instinct of the royal prisoner. A gray bundle of stuff from the docks had reached the country mansion. What it contained was of little moment, but it was rich with a score of the most piquant and winsome of dock and slum smells. The chords of memory surely dwell in the nose, and Pussy's past was conjured up with dangerous force. Next day the cook left through some trouble over this very bundle. It was the cutting of cables, and that evening the youngest boy of the house, a horrid little American with no proper appreciation of royalty, was tying a tin to the blue-blooded one's tail, doubtless in furtherance of some altruistic project, when Pussy resented the liberty with a paw that wore five big fish-hooks for the occasion. The howl of down-trodden American roused America's mother. The deft and womanly blow that she aimed with her book was miraculously avoided, and Pussy took flight, upstairs, of course. A hunted rat runs downstairs, a hunted dog goes on the level, a hunted cat runs up. She hid in the garret, baffled discovery, and waited till night came. Then, gliding downstairs, she tried each screen door in turn till she found one unlatched and escaped into the black August night. Pitch black to man's eyes, it was simply gray to her, and she glided through the disgusting shrubbery and flower beds, took a final nip at that one little bush that had been an attractive spot in the garden, and boldly took her back track of the spring. How could she take a back track that she never saw? There is, in all animals, some sense of direction. It is very low in man and very high in horses, but cats have a large gift, and this mysterious guide took her westward, not clearly and definitely, but with a general impulse that was made definite simply because the road was easy to travel. In an hour, she had covered 2 miles and reached the Hudson River. Her nose had told her many times that the course was true. Smell after smell came back, just as a man, after walking a mile in a strange street, may not recall a single feature, but will remember, on seeing it again, "Why, yes, I saw this before." So Kitty's main guide was the sense of direction, but it was her nose that kept reassuring her. "Yes, now you are right. We passed this place last spring." At the river was the railroad. She could not go on the water. She must go north or south. This was a case where her sense of direction was clear. It said, "Go south," and Kitty trotted down the footpath between the iron rails and the fence. End of section 2. Recording by Jenny Blankenship, Culloden, West Virginia.